I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Martha's Vineyard residents and WCAI listeners will recognize Nelson Siegelman as a longtime columnist, reporter, and most recently editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. For many of his readers, his hunting and fishing column was his apt portrayal of the challenges and joys of outdoor sportsmanship combined with his wit and sense of humor that many admired. He's compiled his columns into a collection titled Martha's Vineyard Outdoors, Fishing, Hunting, and Avoiding Divorce. Good to see you again, Nelson. Thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, so tell us a little bit about this book, and you describe yourself sort of as an accidental writer. What is that, an accidental writer?
Well, I was an accident to a lot of things, I think. But when I moved to the vineyard, it was really because I'd been coming down here fishing, and I decided I needed a change. I was living up in Boston, and I took a job at the Martha's Vineyard Times selling advertising, of all things. I figured we'll see how this goes, and it was very nice because I could go and visit a couple of businesses and then hit the beach with my fishing rod. And after my first year here, I asked the then editor and co-owner, Doug Cabral, if he thought a fishing column would be a good idea. And I started writing a fishing column on the vineyard, and that would have been 1990, I guess. Mm. It was funny to think about it because then 26 years later, I was still writing a fishing column. And after a few years of writing the fishing column, Doug recognized some bit of affinity for telling stories and asked me if I wouldn't like to be a reporter. And I agreed that because I like the writing part. And, you know, the funny part is you end up writing a column. The summer would roll around and I'd think, what am I going to write about? I mean, really, how many ways can you talk about how to catch a bluefish? But the funny part about it is that on the vineyard, something always happens. I mean, and after a certain point, other fishermen are ratting out their fellow fishermen to call you up because they want to tell you the most embarrassing thing they can think about their friends, so that, you know, their friend that fell off the rock. And there's one story there about a fellow that said he was attacked by a seal.
Right, right. It was like a blue baby seal.
It was like compared to the story of Rashomon, you know, with three different versions. And I always laugh because, you know, one of the things about writing a column, of course, is you have to pretend when someone's telling you these stories that you're not really listening hard, but you are listening hard because you're thinking, that's great, I'm going to write about that later. But if you let on that you're going to write about
it, they won't tell you everything.
Right. Yeah. You need to keep it all quite relaxed.
Yeah, and I love when the story with the seal, what did the other guy say? What was it, the line?
It was Ned Casey and Joe Chapman. And Ned, as he walked out the door after telling this story, he said something like, do it up big, Nelson.
Yeah,
make Joe a real schmuck.
<It's funny.
laughs> Something like that.
All right. So read us part of it. You've got a column here that you want to read a little something from.
Well, I guess I have to set it up a little bit. This is a column. It's one of my favorite ones, actually, because, again, this is just exactly in keeping with what I was talking about. We have, for your listeners that aren't familiar with it, the Martha's Vineyard Striped Bass and Bluefish Derby, which has been going on more than seven decades. It's a five-week fishing tournament in the fall. If you stop to think that about 3,000 people enter the Derby. Now, almost half of those are islanders. So if you think of everybody that's affected by that fisherman, the spouse, the employer, probably, other than a power outage, no other event affects the island as much as the Derby. So it's a big deal. People really get into it. And this fellow, Bob, they called him Hawkeye, was his nickname, Bob Hawkeye Jacobs, was one of these intense Derby fishermen, always fishing day and night. So he called me up at the Times. So he wanted to tell me this story. And I'm listening to it, and I hit my recorder, and Bob is telling me this crazy story. I have to tell you, it's just crazy. But the way he was describing it to me would be like you telling me about something, well, I had to mow the lawn, and then I had to. He thought it was perfectly normal, but that's because he was talking to another fisherman, and in that world, it was normal. But he had caught what we call a false albacore. We call him an albie, off of Memorial Wharf dock in Edgartown. And it's very difficult to hook a big albie during the Derby. And particularly in Edgartown Harbor, where you have moorings and you have the little ferry that goes to Chappie. So here's Bob. He's on this dock. He's hooked this Albee. And now in comes the Pied Piper ferry, which operates in the summertime and in the fall between Falmouth and Edgartown. The ferry ties up, and Bob's Albee goes out, and the line is under the ferry. Now, there's a small sort of informal group of people that fish on Memorial Wharf, and they tend to help each other out. So I'm going to pick up the story where the line is under the boat. All of this activity went unseen by the regular wharf rats, who are part of an unofficial club each derby. Bob asked an accommodating crew member to tell one of the fishermen to bring the long-handled net the regulars keep handy. Dennis Guff of West Tisbury came on board with the net. Despite several efforts to use his rod tip to free the fish, the line remained pinned under the boat. Unwilling to break off his fish, Bob reviewed his options. "I realized that I had my mask, my fins, and my snorkel in my car," Bob said. "I thought, maybe if I put on my skin diving equipment, I could get down there and free it, then get back on the wharf, jump back on the boat, and play him." "And that seemed reasonable?" I asked. "Yeah, it did," Bob said. Bob asked Dennis to grab his mask and snorkel from his car. He explained to me that it was a beautiful hot day and slack tide. Bob and Dennis talked over the best strategy in order to avoid violating derby rules, which prohibit anyone else from touching the line during the fight. They decided Bob should lean his rod against the boat and loosen the reel's drag. I asked Bob if Dennis reacted to him as though he were the slightest bit crazy. "No, he didn't," Bob said. "Not at all." Dennis went to get the mask and snorkel out of Bob's car. Bob stripped down to his pants and emptied his pockets. Pointing to a larger unseen derby force at work, Bob said, "Somehow there was a Ziploc food storage bag lying on the boat passenger bench where I was. It was like it was put there just to store the stuff in my pocket." Now, you might wonder what the crew is thinking about all of this fishing activity. Bob said when he first boarded the boat and began trying to free his fish, one crew member did get a bit exercised. "She comes running up at me, really nasty, really challenging, and she goes, 'Sir, what are you doing on our boat?' And I just said to her, 'Yeah, I've got a fish on.' And then I tuned her out. And I realized later, yeah, a fish on. That explains it." The derby logic at work. Other crew members proved more accommodating as Bob donned his mask and snorkel. He jumped in the water. It's hard to know what the fish thought at that point. But there was a problem. The line went under the center of the boat, requiring a deeper dive than Bob had expected, and he hadn't asked Dennis to bring his swim fins, which were still in the car. Bob made a few quick dives to assess the situation. The water was murky. He was hesitant to dive under the midsection of the boat without fins. Bob thought about asking Dennis to get the fins, but as he treaded water, a crew member told him, "You've got 1 minute." He went under and came up. "You've got 30 seconds, said the crew member. "We've got to stay on our schedule." The Pied Piper pulled away from the dock with Bob's derby hope. Later, talking like he could have been a contender if only he had his fins, Bob said, "I think I ran out of time." Bob, who fished his first derby in 1974, admitted that it might be difficult for those unfamiliar with how difficult and time-consuming it is to catch a big Albee to understand his swim. "It might not be that easy to make them really understand," Bob said. "I can explain why it was worth the effort to me, maybe, but I don't know that anybody else would agree. I know how hard it is to find a big Albee. It might take me 2 weeks to find a big Albee. And there I had one on my line." No matter how inexplicable the derby may be to the uninitiated, sometimes derby fishermen and other people intersect in odd ways. Bob was back at Memorial Wharf bait fishing with another fisherman on Monday evening when a young woman in her 20s walked up, highly agitated and near tears. Speaking with an accent, she asked, "Do either one of you have a big hook?" "Big hook," Bob said. "What do you need a big hook? Why do you need it?" "My bicycle fell in the water. Can you catch my bicycle?" Always ready to help a European damsel in distress, Bob and his pal Dom rigged a big treble hook used for snagging bunker to a piece of clothesline, part of the flotsam and jetsam in Bob's vehicle. Dom began fishing for the bicycle. Within a few minutes, he hooked something. "He starts pulling it up," Bob said, "and it's one of those long tools used to open up manhole covers, and it's attached to a wheel. Son of a gun, it's a bicycle. But it's not hers. It's a different bicycle." The guys go back to fishing unsuccessfully for the woman's bike, and Bob gets an idea. He has a mask, fins, and snorkel in his car, but he wasn't anxious to go back in the water a second day in a row. Luckily, Dom snagged a mountain bicycle, the correct one, and brought it to the surface. "She was just so grateful," Bob said. "I think it was a rental."
Oh, so funny. So you've been writing that column for a long, long time, so, and going through choosing which, you know, pieces you're going to put in the book. How has your writing style or voice changed since you first started writing that fishing column?
Well, I think that one of the things I learned was to listen to people a little bit more and let them tell the story, that in many ways I didn't have to tell the story. And I think that's true of just being a reporter even. And, you know, we've, as you, I'm sure, will attest, sometimes you end up talking too much. Yeah. And I would listen to these tapes early on and say, "God, why don't
I... Be quiet, Nelson."
Yeah, stop. Let him tell a story. And, you know, for example, this story, I just had to set it up. I mean, it was just great, you know. I think that would probably be the biggest thing. Over the years, I realized that, you know, you just pick up techniques of putting it together. And part of it is being curious about what people are telling you and asking them the questions that are going to have, you know, just bring out the best in them. But a lot of these stories, I mean, really, yeah. You know, part of it was the easy part, just listening to them.
And of course, covering the news is different than the column. It's a different way. And your first news story, I thought, was pretty funny. You got to go up. Tell us about the first news story that you did.
Well, yes. Someone was building a house out on Cape Hogue on Chappaquiddick. For those not familiar with it, it's really the end of Martha's Vineyard. It's on the Chappaquiddick is on the eastern end. It's all sand. The only way to reach Cape Hogue is either over the beach or by water. And this fellow is building a house out by the lighthouse there. And in order to create a foundation, he had to bring gravel over from a staging area, and he was transporting it by helicopter. So they would load this big canvas bag, is the only thing I can compare it to, a big canvas bag up with gravel, hook it to the helicopter, then carry it over the water to this site. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. That'd make a really neat story. So I went to the helicopter pilot, who, when he wasn't doing that sort of thing, would be crop dusting cranberry bogs, asked him if I could go up, and he said, sure. So I met him at the appointed time. He gave me, you know, put me in the helicopter seat and gave me the headphones and all this. Meanwhile, his dog, a big black lab, is in the helicopter, and he's explaining to me that, well, don't touch this, don't touch that. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, we're carrying a quarter ton of stone under us. I'm not going to touch anything, but what about your
dog?
Anybody that knows labs know they can get really rambunctious.
That tail, you never
know.
Yeah,
I had this image of his dog deciding it had to jump in my lap.
But it didn't.
No, thank goodness.
Yeah, that's funny. So the island, of course, can be a very small community, especially in the off season. So what were some of the challenges of being a reporter and later the editor of the paper when you and your family live there? You run into these folks every day.
Well, yeah, I think it's true of being in a community newspaper. Working for a community newspaper really keeps you honest. You know, we would see these reporters come during the presidential visits, and in many ways I thought a lot of them were just making widgets. Mm-hmm. They really, you know, they just had to crank out a story. They weren't in touch with their people, their readers. They may have known they were familiar with the, you know, the handlers, but on the island, if I wrote about somebody, I knew I was going to run into them at some point, or my wife would run into somebody that she knew who knew these folks. And in some ways, that's very good, because when you're writing a story, you're aware of the impact on that individual or his family or his friends. You know, I wrote a number of stories. Sometimes you get to write really uplifting stories. Sometimes the stories are not very uplifting. Mm-hmm. You're writing about people that have been arrested for serious crimes. And you know these people. There was one fellow who I knew. I had covered him in his professional capacity. He'd been the chairman of a school building committee, very respected member of the community. And he was arrested for child molestation. And what I would always just try and do is call that person up and just say, what are you, you know, what would you like to say? Always give him a kind of fear shot. I think that's really what you know, being a community reporter is all about. Yeah. So.
You wrote something in the introduction that struck me, and you just touched on it. You wrote, over the years, I met reporters from the large dailies on island to cover a presidential visit. I was always struck by the contrast between their relationship with their readers, distant, with the newsmakers, closer. I always sat in one corner or another of the Times' large open office, and over the years, readers, and lots of fishermen, walked right in to tell me about a story, ask a question, or vent angrily. Just the way it should be, I thought.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, there were no, at least in our office, I was in a part of a big open floor plan. I didn't mind that at all. If people came in and they were angry, I'd take them somewhere else where we could speak a little bit private. But I liked having people walk in. You know, sometimes obviously it would be irritating because you're involved in something.
You're on deadline, yeah.
Yeah, you're really busy, and they think you're just been sitting there waiting for them to walk in and tell you about the big striped bass they caught last night. You know, a lot of people, it was funny. They thought I was probably better known for writing a fishing column on Martha's Vineyard than some of the really important news stories that I covered. But you know, again, that's part of living in a small community. And the upside of that is when there's when you've had some success or when your family is having a problem, you know, there are people that are there to back you up. I'll tell you one quick story that sort of stuck with me that was really nice. A year or so ago, a fisherman drowned while working off of Nantucket. And when those sorts of stories came up, I would really spend a lot of time, as much as I could, to really tell about that person. Who was this person, their family, and do what I could both for the family and for our readers and their friends. So I was at the paper in the parking lot on a Saturday. I was doing some work, and I was about to get out. I'd just gotten out of my truck, and a fellow came over and said, oh, are you Nelson Siegelman? And I said yes, and you know, sort of waiting for the next shoe to drop. And he said, well, I'm a friend of Luke Gurney's, and I just wanted to tell you that I really appreciated the story you wrote about him. And you know, it's one of those small moments in a parking lot. Nobody else is going to know about it, but that was the sort of thing that would really motivate me and made it all seem so rewarding at times, was that the story that you knew you'd spent a lot of time on, that it really meant something to people.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation with Nelson Siegelman this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Nelson Siegelman. His new book is Martha's Vineyard Outdoors, Fishing, Hunting, and Avoiding a Divorce. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Okay, so before you came to the vineyard, how much hunting and fishing had you done?
Well, I'd always been a fisherman. I used to go fishing with my dad. I grew up in Boston. We'd go and rent a little skiff at a place called Howe's Neck in Quincy. Quincy used to be called the flounder capital of the world. And we would go and catch a peach basket full of flounder. And, you know, so that's, I grew up doing that, but I had never hunted until I came to Martha's Vineyard. And it's funny, the first hunting I did was bird hunting because my wife and I, we had a young daughter, we're caretaking on a property in Chilmark, and I wanted my daughter to grow up with a dog. So we got a black lab puppy. We went to get this dog. There were about eight puppies, and this one puppy came crashing over a barrier to me. And this is how dumb I was about dogs. I thought, oh, the dog likes me. Little did I know that he would retain that characteristic of crashing through everything the rest of his life. But his name was Tashmu, and my good friend Cooper Jilks, Coop, with so many things, he introduced me to duck hunting. We went out to Chappie to Coop shot a duck. I couldn't hit anything. And my dog went plunging into the freezing water. I thought, wow, is that cool or what? Yeah. You know, this lab doing exactly what its DNA told it to do, because God knows I hadn't trained to do that. Of course, then it wouldn't give me the duck. I was running up and down the beach with it. But that training came later. But, you know, that's I got introduced to hunting on the island. Now I'm an avid deer hunter, duck hunter, and
Yeah. And going back to the fishing, you talk a bit about the difference between fishing and golfing and some of the benefits of fishing. And we're thinking of, you know, some of the presidential visits, you know, President Clinton, President Sure. Obama. They're always seen with the pictures golfing. And you use this example of two photos. So tell us about that. Let's see the picture of the president golfing and the picture of the president fishing.
Well, when we, you know, that first presidential visit, I wrote a column about Clinton. I suggested that Clinton go fishing. I thought, this is, you know, he's an Arkansas boy, right? He must like to bass fish. And of course, I was looking for the big scoop. You know, I had this idea that somehow Clinton would call me up and we'd go out to Waysquee and surf fish together. And wouldn't that be something? But as I thought about it, he would go golfing whenever he was on the island. And I thought, you know, whenever you see two fishermen together, you look at them and if you're wondering what they're talking about, you think they're talking about fishing. You could stick anybody in a pair of waders with a fishing rod, put them out on Waysquee, and it's going to look pretty wholesome. You stick the same two guys in a golf cart, one's whispering to the other, and you're thinking, what are they talking about?
Politics.
Politics, business, their girlfriends, their wives. You know, it's just a completely different image that it presents. And I think that, you know, there's a wonderful quote that I found. It's by this fellow who was a fisherman and a writer. His name is Francis Endicott. In 1882, he came to Martha's Vineyard. He went to Cuttyhunk and a number of places to visit these old bass clubs. And I love this quote. So he says, "Father Neptune is no respecter of persons, and spatters his royal favors so lavishly and so impartially on the just and the unjust that, unless you are a believer in the longshore theory that salt water never hurts nobody, and can take a thorough soaking philosophically, and as a matter of course, you had better give up all thought of being a bass fisherman." And that's so true. I just love, you know, his insight. Unless you can take a soaking philosophically. And I can't tell you, you know, how many times I've thought, particularly during the Derby, whoa, the wind's blowing 180 miles an hour, the rain's coming down, nobody else will be fishing. I'll go out here and I'll catch the Derby winner. And of course, I get someplace and, you know,
it's crowded.
Oh, yeah, there are eight other crazy people there. You see that at Menemsha during the Derby. I mean, the wind can be blowing 50 miles an hour and there will be people on that jetty.
All right. So also some interesting thoughts on the best presidential fisherman, which you had a conversation and you said, okay, who's the best presidential fisherman? And the idea was it was maybe Jimmy Carter.
Yes. And that was an interview I had with Hal Raines, who, you know, I don't know anything about the history of presidents and fishermen, but Hal Raines, who was until he got booted out of there, the editor of the New York Times. And he was a pretty interesting fellow. And this is one of the kind of neat things, I guess, about being on the vineyard is that I called up Hal Raines, and he had just written a book, Fly Fishing, I think it was Fly Fishing Through a Midlife Crisis. And I invited him to come to the vineyard to do a talk and to come fishing. And, of course, it was the fishing that got him to come to the island. And he explained that there are a number there are a number of fishermen who like to, a number of presidents who like to fish, but, you know, he thought that Jimmy Carter was the, I guess, the most artful because he tied flies and he was a fly fisherman and really kind of understood the craft.
And the thing I loved the best about that was that President Jimmy Carter would go to Camp David and then secretly take a helicopter to fish Spring Creek near Penn State. That is just, I mean, just the image of that, that, you know, here you are, you think your president's Camp David, and he's sneaking off to go fishing. And do you think part of that appeal and, like, your whole thing where you say, hey, you get the pictures with the fishing versus the golf, you're going to get some you know, rate increases in your poll numbers. Mm. Is it, do you think, because it relates, because people can relate? So there's so many people who fish, and I don't mean just men fishing. I mean, there are a lot of women fishermen, too.
Oh, yeah. If you go to the Derby and see some of these women, they're as enthusiastic and as dedicated as any of the men, believe me. They're, you know, don't get in their way.
Yeah.
is all I can say. Well, fishing is one of the most popular sports in the United States, so it stands to reason that people can relate to it. And, you know, to go back to that quote, when you're standing on that beach casting, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are. You know, the rain's falling on you and it's falling on the person next to you. And that's one of the wonderful things, I think, about fishing on the vineyard, particularly, again, during the Derby. I've met so many people from so many different backgrounds and walks of life. When you're on that beach and it's dark there and you're just chatting about, you know, the bass you caught or how the fishing's been, You're not asking anybody what their stock portfolio looks like.
Right. And you actually got to meet President Obama. You didn't get to go fishing with President Clinton, as you thought you might, but you did get to meet President Obama, right?
Well, momentarily, he walked out of the Bunch of Grapes bookstore, and I was a small group, and he shook my hand. You know, this is sort of funny now looking back on it. Clinton was a lot more accessible when he came to visit the island. He would get out and about, and I could have gone to a party that he held for the press as his vacation was winding down, but I went fishing.
What a surprise.
Fishing instead.
All right, so describe the community that's formed around fishing and hunting on the island. This is, as you're saying, you've got people from all walks of life. You never know, you know, you don't know who you're standing next to, right? I mean, it could be.
Well, you know, the vineyard often is portrayed as this wealthy community with Hollywood celebrities and cocktail parties, and there's that. But there's really a community of people that also value the outdoors. They value the outdoor experience. They enjoy, you know, I can be on a marsh duck hunting on Martha's Vineyard, and really I'm transported to those old hunting clubs of 80, 90, 100 years ago. And it's the same when you're on the beach and when you're with different people that you just sort of run into. You know them only by their first name. And you develop friendships that are of long-standing duration. And that's one of the wonderful things about that, the camaraderie that exists in the community.
And of course, the vineyard has a long history of hunting and fishing. And you include a photograph from 1911 of the Tisbury Pond Club members in the book.
Yes, yeah, isn't that wonderful?
So how much of a draw was hunting and fishing for tourism on the island over the years? And how have outdoor sports helped shape the character of the community?
Well, you know, the Tisbury Pond Club is a very good example of that, because these were men, they were, you know, the wealthy men of their time. They would come from Boston or from New York, and they would come to this rustic, simple club, and they would spend, a week duck hunting. Yet they had these relationships with islanders as well that was also quite close. A lot of times it was an employee-employer relationship, but it was still a little bit different. These were people who became, in a way, a sort of extended island family. And to speak of the Tisbury Pond Club, when that club existed for a number of years, it was on Tisbury Great Pond. As the membership died off, the hunting went downhill. The three remaining members of that club gave that property to the trustees of reservations. Now, they could have sold that for millions and millions, but they wanted people to be able to enjoy that property. And I would go out there duck hunting with a good friend of mine, Allie Moore. And I remember one day we were walking out. We had the dogs. It was in the fall. The dogs were running around. And a fellow was coming off the property, and he sort of admonished us that, you know, those dogs have to be on a leash. And I told him, I said, well, I'll tell you what, if you'll swim out and get our ducks, we'll put our dogs on a leash. And, you know, of course, I was being a typical Boston wise guy, which I haven't lost some of that. But the fact remains that a lot of people who enjoy that property don't realize that that property was preserved for the benefit of the public through hunters.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that that gets missed.
Yeah. You know, we're talking about some of the folks that you're fishing with that you don't really know a lot about. And I'm thinking of Angie.
Yes, Albert Angelone.
Yeah, talk about it. This is such an interesting story. A great fisherman, and there was so much about him that you didn't know until he died.
I was absolutely stunned. You know, Albert Angelone, we called him Angie, he was sort of short fellow, had a real Jersey accent. I used to always run into him often at Coop's Tackle Shop or around the island. And, you know, he'd speak with me. He'd always be very polite. He'd go, Mr. Siegelman, Mr. Siegelman. And I go, Angie, call me Nelson. He'd go, okay, Mr. Siegelman, okay. And he'd start telling me about some fish he caught. He was a very good fisherman, fished all the time, loved to go fishing with his wife, Mary Ann. And I was always looking for good fishing stories. So I'd say, Angie, do you have a photo of that bass you caught? He'd go, and he'd say, no photos. But the funny thing was, when he'd tell me about a place where the fishing was good, he'd always say, protect that with your life.
With your life.
And it didn't mean much to me until Angie died. What had happened is he was supposed to meet his wife. He had a doctor's appointment. He didn't show up, which is very unusual. He was very punctual, very devoted to his family. So they found Angie. He'd suffered a heart attack. He was in his waders on a beach, which, you know, was the way probably every fisherman would like to go. And I called up the family and I said, look, if you'd like, I'll help you write an obituary, which I often try to do for people because, you know, not everyone's familiar with writing an obit. Well, I thought this was going to be a pretty straightforward type of story. Then I find out that Angie was a highly decorated, highly respected Secret Service agent. He'd retired to the island, but he'd been in the Secret Service working undercover against the mob in New York City. And then, of all things, he got assigned to Gerald Ford's White House presidential detail. I was just astounded, you know, because I'm finding this all out by talking to the head of the Secret Service in New York City, who never talks to reporters.
Right, of course.
And he's telling me one Angie story after another, and then going, well, but you can't use that. You can't use this. And the one that he told me, because Angie was missing the tips of three of his fingers, they were training Israeli Secret Service agents to drive the heavy armored presidential limo, and one of them slammed the door on Angie's hand. He didn't want me to tell. They weren't supposed to be training Israeli agents at the time. So as long as I just changed it to some agents from a foreign country, I could use the story. But, you know, so this story ended up taking a couple of days, but I was able to get a photo from the presidential library. And there's the assassination attempt on Gerald Ford. And who's there? As everybody's ducking for cover, Angie.
Yeah, wow. What a story.
Standing tall.
Yeah, we're talking with Nelson Siegelman. His book is Martha's Vineyard Outdoors, Fishing, Hunting, and Avoiding Divorce. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More stories after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Nelson Siegelman. His new book is Martha's Vineyard Outdoors, Fishing, Hunting, and Avoiding a Divorce. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so the title of the book, Martha's Vineyard Outdoors, Fishing, Hunting, and Avoiding Divorce on a Small Island, which begs the question, does hunting and fishing put one at risk for divorce?
Well, there are probably a number of people in the listening audience that could attest to that. It certainly can put a strain on a marriage. I have to say, I'm very lucky. I married a good woman in spite of myself, because God knows my wife is, you know, has infinite patience. But I'm lucky because she grew up pretty much on the island, so she's used to that sort of culture. But I don't know what it is, you know.
I can tell you what it is. It's like a sickness. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
It's
like
yes.
you've got stories in here where you know you and your fellow fishermen, you're supposed to be somewhere. It's Mother's Day. I think you said you were going to cook dinner for your wife and daughter, and somebody else had dinner reservations. Yet you guys are still out there fishing. And you're like, we got to go. Well, maybe just one more stop here, one more stop there, and that's typical.
It's mental illness. It's really a mental illness, and the problem is that you have people around you who reinforce this illness.
Right.
I mean, you know, the little voice is screaming at me, Nelson.
Yeah.
Even before I came to the vineyard once, I stopped at the South River to fish for shad. I was supposed to be at a business meeting where I used to work, and it was just so beautiful. It was a beautiful spring day.
Just have to stop.
Yeah,
just for a minute.
Am I going to say when I roll in, you know, a half hour late? Oh, sorry, Mike, I was fishing on South River for shad.
Yeah, and I will say you've got some great funny stories in here that include you. Your wife sounds really smart, Nelson, and you don't listen to her. And I'm hoping you've learned your lesson. Like when she told you about the canoe, Nelson, that's not a one-man canoe, but you didn't listen.
No. Yeah. There's nothing a wife enjoys more than being able to say, I told you so, right. And you have to admit she was right. So,
yes. What did you say, Nelson? I was right. All right. So you've got lots of great stories in the book, and there's a couple that I want to talk about because they really stand out to me. And I love the story about the Colorado fisherman who fulfills his dream to catch a bonito on the fly rod. Tell us about this.
Well, this was a fellow. His name was Cliff Thompson. And Cliff had, again, because I was writing the fishing column, he got in touch with me, called me up and said he ran a small newspaper out in Colorado, and he was going to come to the Cape, and he wanted to fish for bonito, and asked if I could help him out with, he probably asked if I knew a charter captain, that sort of thing. And I hooked him up with this fellow, Eddie Lepore. They called him Eddie Benito Lepore, which will give you an idea of why I connected the two. And Eddie wasn't a charter captain, but he was a seasonal fisherman on the vineyard. He and his wife stayed at the family campground. Just a wonderful, wonderful man. I knew immediately that Eddie was the guy to hook Cliff up with. And Eddie met him. Cliff came off the ferry in his wheelchair, and Cliff didn't let that wheelchair interfere with his fishing at all. He was really inspiring in that way. And we got him into Eddie's tin boat, and Eddie got him off of the steamship wharf, and Cliff ended up catching a bonito. And one of the points that sort of has, you know, occurred over and over again to me is that it really, the size of the fish doesn't matter. It's the quality of the experience. Mm-hmm. And there are some people that they don't have to catch a 300-pound, 400-pound tuna or a 40-pound striped bass. They're happy with what that experience has been like. And Cliff he was so excited, and it was just so rewarding for him. And you know what? It was for Eddie, too.
Yeah.
I mean, Eddie couldn't have been happier, than if he'd caught 20 fish that day.
Yeah. And didn't he also end up fishing with the doctor who took care of him in his accident?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and I should mention that what had happened is he was riding his bicycle. He was, he hit the brakes. He went over the handlebar, and that's how he ended up getting paralyzed from the waist down. You know, I was saying earlier to you, like with so many of these stories, I reacquainted myself with these people as I went to collect these stories, and I did. A wonderful thing now is you can put someone's name into a Google search, see if they're around, and I did look to see if I could, look up Cliff, because I contacted a number of people who are in these stories to let them know, hey, the column's in a book, but I didn't find Cliff.
Mm. Well, kind of a common name, too.
Yes.
It would be tough.
All
right, so how much of your passion for hunting and fishing have you shared with your family?
Well,
I know you brought your daughter
right,
fishing.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's a double-edged sword, isn't it now? Probably I shared it too much, so therefore my wife will never go to the beach with me now, because she knows that we may not come off at the time I said we were going to come off the beach. So if I say, Norma, I'm going to go to East Beach. You want to come along? She goes, oh, no, no,
you go ahead.
You go ahead. You go ahead. The same in my boat. She's been in the boat when I've almost run out of gas. So that sort of ended any boat trips as well. And Marlin, my daughter, when she was younger, she didn't really have the enthusiasm for it. And again, you know, I wish I'd been better at this when I first was bringing them out, because, you know, particularly for dads out there, you got to realize when you're taking kids out, you're not fishing for yourself.
You're fishing
for them. And it's so hard. You get enthusiastic. You want them to catch a fish, and it can go overboard. So that's one of the mistakes I'm sure I made.
All right, I got to talk about bait for a second, because you're reminding me, when I used to live in New Hampshire, I lived on this lake, and a friend brought over his little boy, and they were fishing for sunfish, and he was using Velveeta cheese as bait, and just pulling them in.
Hey.
So you just never know, and that makes me think of the story you have in the book of the two guys from Vermont who were using what is not common bait when you're looking for striped bass, right?
No, this frickin' frack there from Vermont, it was so funny, because, you know, Menemsha's a hotbed of island fishermen, and they all like to one-up play, you know, think that they're better than the other guy and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of bragging that goes on there among the different men and women that fish out of the port of Menemsha. These two guys came down from Vermont. They were there with their dad. Their dad was a bit elderly, so they couldn't really take him out on the beach, so they'd stick him in a beach chair on the bulkhead there. And they went to the Stop and Shop, and they got a package of salmon, the kind of salmon that you'd buy to throw on the barbecue grill. And they were catching big, huge striped bass.
That's crazy.
And it was just so funny, you know. And they of course, thought this was great. And the Menemsha Charter guys that were there, they thought it was hilarious as well. But
hey, give it a try, right? You never know.
You never know. And you know what? I bet after they left, there were plenty of guys there fishing with salmon, because people learn quick around.
Whatever, it works, right?
Yes.
And we're talking about the bonding that goes on in fishing and hunting communities. And one of my favorite stories in the book is Jamie Had a Shadow. This is such a great story. Tell us about this.
Well, Jamie was, you know, there are some fishermen that are really well-respected and quite talented and good, and they get a reputation. And Jamie was one of them. And this fellow, his name was Bob, he was sort of like, I think I compare him to gum on your shoe. Yeah. Jamie couldn't get rid of him. You know,
everywhere he goes,
everywhere you go, he was sort of shadowing Jamie, and Jamie played a bit of a trick on him. He brought a milk crate to stand on when he was fishing in Tashmu, so the water would appear more shallow than it was, and Bob ended up tripping and falling in the water and breaking his rod, and Jamie ended up taking him sort of under his wing and giving him a rod to fish with. And it was just, again, you know, some of these stories, they're not big stories, they're out of the way stories, but they're so reflective of a sort of camaraderie and a basic human connection and kindness. And I do like those stories.
And I love this, because this was like, you know, here's Jamie trying to get rid of Bob, and then he plays this trick on him that goes a little bit not what he was expecting. And,
right.
You know, he falls in the water, and Jamie kind of pulls him out. And instead of Bob being mad, saying, "Whoa, what'd you do?" It was like, he was thanking Jamie for helping
right,
him out.
Right,
and
right.
Then it kind of gives Jamie a change of heart, which was, I just love that ending. I just thought that was so sweet. All right, tell us about the cover of the book.
Well, I'm quite happy with this cover. It was done by an artist, Glenn Wolf, who lives out in Minnesota. Some of your older readers will remember Nelson Bryant. He was the longtime outdoor writer for the New York Times, a wonderful man. He lives in West Tisbury. And for many, many years, Glenn Wolf would provide the illustrations that accompanied Nelson Bryant's columns in the New York Times. The two had never met, though it was one of these interesting collaborations. Nelson would write the column, the Times would send the column or describe what was needed to Glenn Wolf, and he'd provide an illustration. Then I think it might have been 1994, a fan of both of men arranged an art show at the West Chop Club, and he invited Glenn Wolf to come and sell some of his artwork. And Nelson Bryant, who lives in West Tisbury, met Glenn for the first time. So that was really kind of neat, and I went to cover the story, and it was good fun to meet Glenn, and I invited Glenn to go fishing that evening. We're standing on this sandbar in Tashmu, stars out. It was gorgeous night, striped bass rising all around us. And I turned to Glenn, and I said, Glenn, you know, this is when it's great to be an artist, because you could never capture this scene with a camera. And about 4 months later, a little package arrived from Minnesota, and it was a watercolor of that evening, two fishermen on a sandbar in Tashmu. It was really a neat... So at any rate, years go by, and we invited Nelson to write something about deer hunting in the on the editorial page of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And I contacted Glenn Wolfe and asked him if he would illustrate the column. And this was a sort of reunion. I didn't tell Nelson about this. I wanted it to be a surprise. So I was really quite happy about all that. And Glenn did this great illustration. So when it came, when I had this book, I thought, well, I can't really use a photograph. I don't want, you know, the, someone just holding a fish. I need something that evokes the spirit of all of this. And I contacted Glenn and asked him if he would do it, and he agreed to. And I sent him a few photos, one of this Sleckman Herbie Hancock carving a decoy and some other sort of scenes that represent stories in the book, the hunting, the fishing, the individuals. And Glenn just captured the mood perfectly. I couldn't have been happier. And every, I have to say, so many people, when they first see the book, comment on the cover.
Yeah. I talked to John, who's giving us a call from Dennis. Hi, John.
Hi. My roommate, who is an extraordinarily colorful character, went fishing and with four condoms, and he caught four big fish.
See,
they
you
look
never
like
know.
Squid.
Oh, my goodness.
There you go.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. See, you never know. You never know.
I'm glad he was from Dennis and not from Martha's Vineyard.
All right, so I also wanted to ask you about the hook removal kit at Martha's Vineyard Hospital.
Yes. If you get shot, you want to be in Boston. If you get a hook in yourself, you want to be on Martha's Vineyard. I'm sure the Nantucket Hospital is just as adept as a removal. I took this dad and his son fishing, and the kid was about 12 years old. And he went to cast this lure like he was taking a golf swing, and he buried this treble hook in the back of his head. I have to tell you, if that had been my daughter, you would have thought we were amputating a limb. You would have heard her
screaming
in Woods Hole from Tisbury Grape Pond. This kid was like a Spartan. I mean, he didn't say ouch, and it wasn't that he was in shock. He was just so nonchalant about this. I clipped off the hook from the lure. We hopped in the car, went to the Martha's Vineyard Hospital emergency room with a brief stop so I could get my notebook and camera, because I knew, oh, this is going to be a story. And, you know, they brought out this little thing, a package which said hook removal kit. I mean, they had it had a tag on a hook removal kit, and really it was nothing more than what you know your average electrician might carry, a pair of vice grips and wire cutters, and they took the hook out. And,
But he did have a little pain when they took the hook out.
Yes.
But up until that point, he was...
This kid was great.
Yeah. Just about 30 seconds left, so... You're writing a column now? Are you still doing a fishing column?
I'm writing for Martha's Vineyard magazine. I'm writing their outdoor column. Right. I'm sort of semi-retired, I guess. But I'm writing, you know, I'm still doing some writing and this is the time between hunting and fishing season.
So this is your lull. Okay.
Yes.
Nelson Siegelman, his book is Martha's Vineyard Outdoors, Fishing, Hunting, and Avoiding a Divorce on a Small Island. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your stories.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.